There is no comparison between the courage of a five-year-old boy and the immeasurable bravery of an infantry soldier who lays down his life for his fellow soldiers. Yet it is a safe bet that somewhere in his childhood, Mitchell Red Cloud faced a defining moment when he had to defend the camp and learned that he was capable of bravery when it was necessary. Fortunately, most of us won't have to experience combat, but we will have to cope with life's challenges and overcome its obstacles. Schoolyard bullies, rush hour traffic, injury, illness, indifference, our own sense of inadequacy, unemployment, indecision, racial prejudice, physical disability, the list is practically endless. There is a nearly constant assault on our sense of well-being and self-esteem, not to mention an occasional or even frequent threat of bodily harm, such as life. In the 1950s and 1960s, yet another challenge swept into the lives of Native Americans on reservations, as if the whole stigma of reservations wasn't challenging enough. We were constantly reminded by certain elements of mainstream American society, missionaries and educators being the most vociferous, that our only course to happiness was to become white in every way possible. Hard work, they told us, was the answer. Buy into the American dream, they advised. The scary part was they had a plan as well, the Employment Assistance Program, otherwise known as relocation. The rationale behind the Bureau of Indian Affairs relocation program was not totally without merit. In order for Indian males to support their families, they needed a trade and work experience. Relocation would give them both by placing them in areas where they could learn a trade while supporting their families. But several factors ensured the program's failure. Indian families who signed up for relocation were moved from their reservations to cities like Cleveland, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Denver, Oakland, Dallas, and so on. Most had never been near a large city, and few knew what to expect. Pitifully little, if any, effort had been made to prepare them for life in a city. Culture shock, to put it mildly, was their first reaction. But the worst aspects were substandard living conditions in slums, less than a living wage, and a lack of appropriate follow-up support by the BIA. It isn't difficult to understand, then, that the first thought in the minds of relocated families was to get home the fastest way possible. Although there were a few success stories, the relocation program did not accomplish its purpose. Most of the families went home to their reservations without finishing the program. More than a few did it by hitchhiking. Almost every Native American family in the country had its brush with relocation, and horror stories abound. Confusion was its primary consequence, as well as yet another reason to distrust the federal government, especially the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Relocation turned out to be just another in a long and continuing list of challenges to be met, something else to be survived. It was the bear that attacked our camp, such as life. The Turtle Lady was one of those who lived bravely. She died a few years ago, and as far as I know, she never married. She was known as a Turtle Lady because she kept a turtle in her handbag. She also had turtle charms and amulets. It was hard to say where she called home. She was known far and wide by Indians and whites alike because she walked everywhere, a woman alone on the highways and back roads of a rural state. Over the years, she crisscrossed the state of South Dakota from one reservation to the next, visiting relatives. Like a turtle, she traveled slowly, but always managed to reach her destination. Her name was Elsie Flood, and she greeted everyone with a smile. And everyone who knew her worried about her personal safety because of her chosen lifestyle. Given that some elements of the state's population were not kindly disposed toward Indians, there was reason for Elsie's friends and relatives to worry. To my knowledge, though she had one or two minor incidents, Elsie was never seriously injured. I'll always admire her because she was quiet and unassuming, the epitome of courtesy and bravery. So was Mac Cash, who was 22 when he died of leukemia. This young man was a student of mine who had graduated from the same high school I did. He was one of the brightest young men I've ever known, and one of the best foosball players around. But I was most impressed with the dignity and courage he exhibited while he knew he was dying. One expects that kind of strength of spirit from elderly people. It is an affirmation of the lives we should strive to live. Dignity and courage from a young person facing imminent death, however, is an inspiration. There are at least two inspiring members of my family. In 1989, my sister Barbara's daughter, Kim, nearing her 17th birthday, died in a car crash. Few things in life are as absolutely heartbreaking as losing a child. Few things as challenging. Whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger, it is said. Barbara found ways to be strong and courageous. She will always have my admiration for that and my undying gratitude for giving me an example to follow. My father, Joseph Marshall II, was a soldier in the 8th Army Air Corps. He saw combat during some of the mop-up operations on the island of Okinawa in 1945. Before that, as a 12-year-old boy, he faced his first test of bravery and passed with flying colors. He became lost in a blizzard with his horse while bringing home supplies for his family. By allowing the horse to find his own way home, my father learned about trust as well as bravery. But his most daunting challenge was cancer. A tumor was removed from his colon in May of last year. That was followed by chemotherapy treatments for several months. The process is not curative. It is only to prolong a life threatened by terminal illness. At the age of 77, he faced the toughest challenge anyone can be given with the quiet dignity and courage of one who is no stranger to adversity. Years ago, my father faced alcoholism and defeated it. He couldn't defeat the cancer, but he taught all of us how to be brave. He died April 14th, 2001. Bravery is a requisite virtue because life demands it. Whether it's cancer, a broken heart, a lost opportunity, a bad business deal, an approaching hurricane, a tough decision, or a dark alley, life will continually throw challenges at us. Any challenge is also an invitation, a standing invitation. The ancient Lakota hunter warrior handcrafted his own bows from ash wood. The strongest bows are made from dry, well-seasoned wood. There are two ways to acquire the kind of wood necessary. The conventional way is to find a young ash tree of the proper height and width, harvest it, and let it dry and cure for at least 5 years. But the hunter warrior was always on the lookout for a mature ash tree that had been struck by lightning. Such a tree had been dried and cured in an instant by the awesome power of lightning, and any bows made from it were by far the strongest. Lightning-struck ash trees were rare, but they were preferred because they had suffered ultimate adversity, and ultimate adversity produces ultimate strength. Such is life. I believe we all have it in us to be brave, that each one of us can defend the camp when it's necessary. Life will give us the opportunity, issuing the invitation to the contest, and as time goes on, we will be shaped and strengthened by our challenges. Whether we win each time or not, we will be tempered by adversity. Soldiers dressed in blue had ridden against the south end of the village in the early afternoon on a hot day during the moon of cherries ripening, or June, and were turned back, outfought by the warriors who had responded to the danger. A new danger came from the north end as another group of soldiers tried to cross the Greasy Grass River and attack the camp. They were driven away as well, and were being chased away toward the north. There was much confusion and noise in a large village that stretched for over 2 miles along the west side of the river. As was the usual procedure when a village was attacked, women and children fled, retreating from the attack. One old woman was concerned about the young men and her family who were in the thick of the fighting across the river. She took her young granddaughter's hand, and together they waded across the river. Warriors rushing past them to join the fight called for them to go back to the village, but they didn't. They gained a small plateau and could plainly see the fighting. A brown cloud of dust hung over the earth, and the firing from the soldiers' and warriors' guns was one continuous noise. They could see the soldiers running and falling as the Lakota and Shahila, or the Northern Cheyenne, drove them relentlessly. The old woman stopped on a low, sharp rise as the soldiers gained a high hill to the northeast. Suddenly, a group of soldiers broke off and ran in her direction, but just as quickly, they were cut down to a man by the advancing warriors. The old woman could sense that victory was at hand, but the guns were still firing as the warriors, many of them on foot, pushed toward the hill, toward a last group of soldiers. The old woman was overcome and began to weep, and then she began to sing. Her clear, strong voice rose amidst the noise of unfettered violence as she sang a strong heart song, a song of courage and honor for the brave warriors defending their people. She raised her arms in prayer and continued to sing one strong heart song after another, while her granddaughter clung to her skirt and watched the battle through wide, fearful, wondering eyes. Soon the guns stopped shooting, and there were shouts of victory. The battle was over, and victory belonged to the Lakota and Shahila. But the old woman kept singing, even as the tears ran down her face. The mounted warrior approached, the strain of combat and the flush of victory on his face. He dismounted and draped a red sash across the old woman's arms. He was a crazy dog warrior, one of an elite group who would often stake themselves in one place during a battle with their red sashes, a visible vow to fight until victory or death. He had seen the old woman, heard her singing, and acknowledged her courage. As he rode away, another warrior appeared and did the same, followed by another and another, until the old woman was covered with red sashes. Another old woman told me the story when I was a boy. Woven into her silvery braids were strips of red cloth, cloth given to her by her grandmother. She was the young girl who stood with her grandmother as she sang strong heart songs during the Greasy Grass fight, also called the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876. Her grandmother had given her the red strips, she said, to remember her by. But the red strips also reminded her that she could be brave, and that's how she faced her blindness every day. Being brave is having or displaying courage during hardship, being strong in the face of pain. If you don't think you know how to be brave, look around. You'll find someone who does know. Follow him or her. If you follow long enough, you'll learn to have courage, or the courage within you will rise to the top. When that happens, turn around, and don't be surprised if someone is following you.